Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is the James Gray Show with the Lords Taverners.
You're listening to a podcast edition of the James Gray Show. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1:30 p.m. on Love Sport Radio on DAB Digital, online, or on your Alexa smart speaker. And if you're listening to the podcast, do leave us a rating and a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Love Sport.
This is the James Gray Show on Love Sport Radio. Of course, looking back on that disappointing result for England last night in Portugal, it all started so well. Marcus Rashford winning that and scoring that penalty. It was downhill from there, unfortunately. Netherlands ran out 3-1 victors. I don't think there's any shame in losing to this Netherlands team, in fairness. They've rebuilt very impressively since missing out on two consecutive major tournaments. Of course, they didn't qualify for Euro 2016. They also failed to qualify for the World Cup in Russia last summer. But they have in their ranks two of the best, if not the two best, defenders in Europe. You know, Virgil van Dijk and Matthias de Ligt, between them, probably worth about 200 million quid now, if not more. And, you know, John Stones and Harry Maguire might hope one day to be the players that Virgil van Dijk and Matthias de Ligt already are. And, you know, this Netherlands team, they've beaten world champions France. They've beaten Germany within the last year. And it's even evolved, actually. Because remember, England beat the Netherlands, March 2018, one of their warm-up games for the World Cup. Beat them 1-0 away from home. Jesse Lingard, I think, got the goal. And, you know, even that Netherlands team, Bas Dost started up front. Patrick van Aanholt started for that team. You know, it was not a... There were parts there that we recognise now. De Ligt played, Van Dijk played, Memphis Depay played. But this is, even since then, a team that has gone on and evolved. They've built a good system. They've got an excellent dynamic going. And in Frenkie de Jong, they've got one of the best midfielders in the world. And that's kind of what England came up against last night. It's not new. For goodness sake, I've got the tennis on in the studio. And I apologise if occasionally I get distracted by Roger Federer doing things that no mere mortal can dream of. A backhand winner there from nowhere, landing on the corner of the baseline and the sideline to win the point. Absolutely fabulous. The fact that Rafa Nadal is beating him so comfortably really is a sign of how good he is on clay. But I wanted to talk about England's struggles against midfield, you know, good midfields. Because they've encountered the same problem in their last two semi-finals in the last year. A classy midfielder setting the tempo of the game and controlling the match. And in Russia, it was Luka Modric. Old news to Real Madrid and Tottenham fans, I suppose. In Portugal, it was Frenkie de Jong, who Barcelona, of course, tied up earlier this year. Now, it's not news that Frenkie de Jong is talented. We've seen what Ajax have done on their run to the Champions League semi-final. We know that he's already been bought by Barcelona. So we know Frenkie de Jong was going to come in. And actually, when you look at the way Ajax play and the way Netherlands play, he plays a very similar role. He drops in deep, he gets the ball, he gives the ball. And that kind of player against a pressing team is very, very damaging. England, meanwhile, were missing almost all of their best midfielders. Harry Winks, Jordan Henderson, Dele Alli. You could arguably start those three as a midfield three, but they were all, of course, recovering from a Champions League final. Now, I don't think Harry Winks was fit enough to play in that Champions League final full stop. Didn't look it anyway, so I don't disagree with not playing them. But it left England woefully short of technical midfielders. They've always been kind of short of technical midfielders, but if there was one thing that last night really highlighted, it was that they need to think about Phil Foden and where he figures. Because if this is the system we're going to play, you know, where we're going to play with two centre-halves who are expected to pass the ball a lot, you need more options. Because centre-halves usually only have two options with the ball. And that makes it very hard to be a good ball-playing centre-half. Let's have a look at three good, three bad from the game.
Good.
Bad.
Marcus Rashford is my first good. He had the chance to lead the line Harry Kane, of course, also not fit enough to start. He wasn't fit enough to start the Champions League final either, but he hoodwinked Mauricio Pochettino into giving him 90 minutes. I love watching Marcus Rashford play through the middle for England because he absolutely loves the work. He's like a racehorse, you know, a good racehorse. Just looks like he's always enjoying running and enjoying working hard. And, you know, that's what Kane gives you as well. Kane gives you that energy up front without the ball. And Rashford is the kind of player who looks like he can do that as well. He's a real nightmare for defenders when he's got the ball as well. He is effective out wide. And what you saw last night was him pulling defenders out of position when he could. And obviously hassling them. And that's how he won the penalty as well. I just love it when he plays through the middle with a bit of freedom. Maybe one day him and Kane could play as a pair.
Bad.
John Stones, the obvious first bad of the night. Maybe we should have seen it coming after Pep basically stopped playing. I mean, he played 90 minutes twice between the end of March before last night. Pep had given up on him effectively. He said, you know what, we've got a title to win here and I just don't trust you to do the job for me. Yeah, the only two times he played 90 minutes, they were both at home and one of them was against Cardiff. The other was against Tottenham, so that's obviously a bit different, but you know, it's not a ringing indictment from one of the best coaches. And, you know, does Southgate really want to continue with the John Stones experiment? He says he does. Is it an experiment? I suppose not. But he says he does, but I don't think John Stones should still be the answer at centre-half for England.
Good!
Jordan Pickford, actually. You know, a guy who gets a lot of stick for various reasons, mostly that terrible Bebo account, but also the fact that he sometimes makes mistakes in goal for Everton. I think other goalkeepers might have struggled. It was such a frenetic game, you know, a kind of horrible, tense, but also very crazy game. I think other keepers would have struggled. He was pretty unlucky to be beaten three times, to be honest. Not really his fault on any of them. Made a great save from Depay with Depay's header. He also made a great save when the second goal fell, when Depay basically had an open goal and Pickford flung himself to make a fine right-handed save. I think he lacks, like so many of that back four, a decent centre midfielder who can offer more options with his feet. And his distribution suffered for the lack of that, but his shot stopping's not under question from me.
Bad.
Kyle Walker never looked comfortable last night, I'm afraid. I don't know what it was. Just people have always had a pop at him. He's one of those easy targets because he's an attacking wing-back and people don't think he can defend, but didn't even think he could really attack last night, to be honest. I didn't even really think he could even do that, which, you know, that's a sad indictment, isn't it? He was sloppy on the ball. He was exploited, I think, off it, and massively out-jumped by Matthias de Ligt for the equaliser.
Good!
Raheem Sterling, you know, a good news story on so many occasions this year, which is terrific news all round. He wore the captain's armband for England for the first time. I'm sure that's been a lifelong dream of his. Maybe one that he never thought would come true because he thought he wouldn't play for England again or thought that his poor form in his early career would lose out on that opportunity or maybe because of the colour of his skin. But he has been such a figure in football this year, both on the pitch and off it. Not a natural spokesperson, not someone who wants to be a figure in race relations, but he's become one. You know, he's kind of had it thrust upon him, and I think he's grown into it massively and almost been more impressive for having tried to do it in a quiet and unassuming way.
Bad.
Ross Barkley, obviously. He really didn't play well last night. I felt a little sorry for him because you put someone like him next to someone like Frankie de Jong, and he's going to look much worse in comparison. Of course he is. But he was also playing a little bit out of position. Didn't look like that technical midfielder who could cope with the idea of coming deep, receiving the ball and passing it on again. That's the whole point of that midfield three. Certainly the deeper one, obviously more so, but that midfield three needs to be able to come into the gaps, come and offer. You know, it's basic coaching, isn't it? What do you say? You say, yeah, offer, show for him. And that was what Barkley needed to do time and time again. And unfortunately, didn't do it well enough. We saw the mistake made for the third goal was exactly the problem that he wasn't able to cope in that particular position. We always knew that Barkley had the physicality, but he's never really seemed to adapt to different tactical systems. That's a problem at Chelsea as well. And this isn't a young Ross Barkley anymore. He's 25. And I think it's time for him to mature as a footballer.
Love Sport.
Now it's time to talk a little bit more England. Matt Nash is on the phone, sports reporter for Metro newspaper. He had the pleasure, or maybe the pain, of watching England lose 3-1 to the Netherlands last night. Matt, always a pleasure to have you on. What did you make of their overall performance? As sloppy as everyone says.
How you doing, James? Yeah, I would say it was one third pleasure and two thirds pain, probably in the end. But it was definitely sloppy. I think England really shot themselves in the foot as much as Holland beat them, really, because there were so many mistakes. It was littered all over the pitch with mistakes. Obviously, the two crucial ones for the second and third Dutch goals, and it just really left a bit of a sour taste in the mouth when England had the possibility to win some silverware, really.
Were you surprised by the starting lineup? That midfield of Rice, Barkley and Delph didn't inspire many fans.
Yeah, it was a little bit surprising. Obviously, Gareth made the decision to leave out all the Champions League players in the end. But it just left a little bit of a void of creativity, perhaps, in terms of Barkley had a decent game until the late mistake. It could be argued. But Delph was decent. But they lacked, possibly, someone like Ali. So Henderson did brilliant when he came on. Ali as well was missed, I think. Winks is another one. So, yeah, we were really lacking in midfield, I would say, last night, in terms of a first-choice midfield, anyway.
There's plenty of already the daggers seem to be out for the England team back home. Do you think that if we start, say, a midfield three of Henderson, Ali and Winks, that is a technically gifted enough midfield to deal with Southgate's style of football?
You'd have to wonder whether it was even a technically gifted enough midfield to deal with the Dutch even last night. Although it's an improvement probably on the starting three, when you see how good Frankie de Jong is, for instance, in the Dutch midfield, it certainly shows that perhaps England are still lacking that that star turn, almost that technical player, someone who can ping the ball about a bit, pick that pass. De Jong was so good last night. It really kind of highlighted what England are missing, really. And I think that's one of Gareth's big tasks now, is to find the right players for that midfield to play the way he wants to play. He's getting there, but I think last night was obviously a setback because he couldn't really play his first-choice starters there.
A lot of people have talked about Phil Foden and James Maddison as two people who have that kind of ability. Do you see either of them being the man for the job?
Yeah, I think Foden's a little way off. Maddison can't be far off, I would say. You'd expect next season Maddison to be getting his chance in the senior team, especially after last night, really. But he definitely needs someone who's got that ability to take the game by the scruff of the neck. The others we mentioned are very good at parts of that game, but they're not really the De Jong or the Modric that England kind of need, that player who's really going to drive us on from the centre of the park.
In terms of Harry Kane, obviously he came off the bench, as you mentioned, all the Champions League players did. Did you think he looked remotely fit? Did it make you think that actually that's what you should have been doing on Saturday?
Well, yeah, I mean, he looked like he had a point to prove, didn't he, really? I think Saturday he was obviously, way off the pace. Last night he looked far livelier, like a man who really wanted to get one over on Virgil van Dijk, get a bit of revenge, but it didn't quite work that way. And there's perhaps an argument for saying that sometimes England play better without Kane, possibly, in some respects. Sancho, Sterling, Rashford was working quite well until Rashford got injured. Kane obviously changes that dynamic a little bit, and is in a little bit of a rut, obviously, over this week with the two games he's played. And I don't think he's really massively benefited either England or Tottenham with his performances. Sometimes he has to play. But how well did he play, and did he justify that? You'd argue probably not.
As the smoke clears this morning, Matt, that might be a more literal phrase than I mean. What's the fan? what has the fan impact to Guimarães been?
Well, I'd say it's probably more in Porto than Guimarães. Over the last couple of days, a lot of the fans left last night to return to Porto. Guimarães sleeps a little easier this morning. I think it's probably the day, but
Has it been overreported? Gary Neville last night saying that the media are just reporting the few making trouble and not the many not making trouble. Well, with respect, Gary, we're not expected to report it when trains do turn up on time, but we do report it when they don't.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can see both sides of the argument. There's so many England fans and behave themselves and are a credit to their country. There's just that the fans, which always cause a trouble, which everyone sort of focuses on because that's the way it is and that's the way we are in the media.
A credit to your country by what? Turning up and not smashing the place up? Like, is that really what we've come to?
Well, I mean, you kind of have to look at the big percentage of people that do follow their country and do it the right way. You know, it really is a small percentage of people that are causing these problems, but it is probably growing, and it is a worry that it's a very young band of fans that are following England all around the world now and that are looking for trouble and are leaving their mark on places like Porto and Guimarães in this way, really, because the locals, while a lot of them are glad for the revenue that England fans bring in, they're also quite glad to see the back of them in some ways. You know, this is a small, quiet place, Guimarães, and it's probably not quite been the same for the last few days. People have actually, you know, gone out of town to get away from some of the football that's been coming.
Just finally, Matt, we've got a third-place playoff now, haven't we?
Yes. Yeah, apparently so. I think we're all looking forward to that, aren't we?
I can't wait. I'm thinking of booking flights out especially.
Yeah, it's going to be the highlight of the season. What a way to end the season domestically for England as well. You know, playing a third, fourth place playoff against Switzerland back in Guimarães. It really does feel like a damn squib. It's going to be a non-event completely. I don't even know how many England fans are going to be coming to that. I would imagine quite a lot have already started to head home.
Well, yes, it's a sort of police bail pending. Matt, thank you very much for joining us. Always a pleasure to have you on. Matt Nash there, sports reporter for the Metro out in Porto. He, of course, has been covering the game and all the shenanigans that seem to go with England away these days, I'm afraid. I wish I were being flippant, but I'm not. It happens every year. Amsterdam last year, Porto this.
Love sports.
Let's speak to Danny Mills, who's not at Roland Garros, but he did have to watch England last night, which I think was probably not that enjoyable. Danny, when a team plays like that in such an error-strewn way, what conclusion can you draw from it?
I can conclude I'd rather than at Roland Garros.
yeah, wouldn't we all, mate?
I mean, it's very fine margins, isn't it? Obviously, Jesse Lingard was offside. It doesn't matter whether it's a yard, an inch, you know, 10 yards. He was offside, simple as that. But if that hadn't been the case, it's a battling performance and it's a good result. And England dug in and we got through it, even though we weren't quite as good as the Dutch. But of course, it goes the other way. And there's all sorts been talked about. And I have to go back to it and say, you know, it was not the game plan that's the issue. Playing out from the back is not the problem. It was individual errors. And hindsight's a wonderful thing. Chris Robshaw in the World Cup against Wales, when he decided England were 5 metres from the try line, you know, and decided, OK, I think we're going to have a tap penalty or scrum, whatever it was in that corner, and go for the win. It didn't work and they lost. And then it was the worst decision on the planet. Mm. It wasn't. It was just, I think, the line-out was horrendous.
Yes.
And the execution of it was poor. And that's what it is. Yes, of course, you can't play out in the back constantly just for the sake of it. You have to vary it at times, and players have to learn when to do it and when not to do it. But in the situations they were in, you know, the first one, was John Stones under real loads of pressure? No. And he made a mistake. You can't account for that. The second one, yeah, we've seen that many times. Ross Barkley just gets it wrong. You know, it's a bad pass, and he passes it to the wrong colour shirt. Again, that's not because they were trying to play out from the back. It's simply an individual error.
Would you take issue with the accusation that the players involved last night, particularly in midfield, are not the kind of technical players who have enough ability to play that style at that level?
I would probably agree with that, you know, to some point. You know, when you look at the sort of players that you're asking to play that way, is our midfield, as an England person, is it the strongest in the world? No, it's not. Actually, our forward line is very, very good. We have some good fullbacks. We have a good up-and-coming goalkeeper. But actually, the midfield, in terms of getting on the ball and playing, is probably a weakish issue for England when you look at what other what other countries have to play that way. But this is the way that Gareth has decided to play. You know, this is the way that a lot of teams are now playing. And I've heard people say, yeah, but, you know, Busquets and this, that and the other. These players have been playing this system and that way since they were 4 or 5 years old. English football has only really been playing out from the back properly for 3 seasons.
Mm.
You know, and that's what it is. I know, you know, okay, John Stones has been able to do that. But Pep Guardiola changed the face of English football.
Yeah.
You know, it's only since he really came in that suddenly the goalkeeper is start to pass it out from the back. And we've seen what Ederson does. So it's going to take time to get this right. Do you go back to the old ways of just lumping it forward at every opportunity? No, because you give the ball away and you get beat. We tried that. It didn't work. So you have to have a little mix. And there are times where you have to go long. And Gareth will have said that to his players. He would have said, you know, don't play out from the back for the sake of it. That's just idiotic.
Well,
that's
look, when we beat Spain, you know, how many of those goals came from quick, long distribution? Clearly, there has to be a middle way here. I just wonder.
So again, it comes down to individual players making those decisions. Are our players good enough at the top level to make those decisions? Is John Stones first choice centre back on the Man City team sheet?
Well, no.
Well, so therefore, why? He's working under one of the best coaches in the world, and he doesn't think he's not his first choice. So therefore, there are better players out there than John Stones to do that job. Harry Maguire, is he as good as the season before last and as he was in the World Cup? Don't think he has quite been this season. So, you know, and then you ask him midfield players. Fabian Delph can't get in the Manchester City team. You know, it's not any fault of his own, but he's not particularly match fit. He's maybe not sharp, and that's not his particular game. So then suddenly you're asking players to fit in and play a system where maybe it's not their strongest point. But do you change your whole system and way of playing because of that? No, I don't think you can. I think you have to just continue with what you're doing and look at it and learn from it.
Do you think it might be a bit of a wake-up call last night for Southgate, and that he might look to someone like Phil Foden, a more technical midfielder who can maybe cope with the rigours of this style?
Yeah, but he's unproven. You know, and this is the problem. Who would be those players that you put into that situation? You know, Jordan Henderson, captain, Champions League winner. That's not his forte, you know, of getting on the ball and dictating the tempo of play. You know, we don't have a De Jong in our side. We don't have a Christian Eriksen that someone's going to get on the ball and dictate. We don't have a Sergio Busquets, you know.
Do you see Harry Winks as someone who could become that player, for example?
Possibly, but he's not there yet. He's not that for Tottenham. So how can you expect him to be that, you know, at an international level? Phil Foden can't even get in the Man City team. He's had, a handful of starts?
But then Southgate has talked about this, and he said, well, sometimes you've got to give them the go at international level, and that becomes where they blood themselves.
You can often do that with forward players. Mm. It's rare that you would do that with a centre-back, a goalkeeper, or a central midfielder, where those positions are about experience, about, you know, key areas of the pitch. If a forward has a bad game, doesn't really make too much difference. He misses a few chances. Okay, you can deal with that. You've got 9 or 10 players behind him to mop up. If midfielders start giving it away and have a bad game, or, you know, if it's a defender, you're in problems. Ross Barkley is not first choice at Chelsea, you know, but he's there for him. We just, let's be realistic about this. Gareth said after the World Cup, we are not the fourth best team in the world. You know, let's be a little bit realistic. We had a good run. We did very well in the tournament, but we've got a long way to go. And I think that's what it is. We got carried away a little bit because of the success of last summer and obviously through the Nations League.
But the weather. I think honestly, I'm not being funny, but I really do think it was just one of those summers.
When you look at our players individually, are they up there as the four best in the world? Would all our players get into the other top three sides, top four sides around the world? Well, I don't think they would.
Not many of them, that's for sure.
No, they wouldn't. You know, simple as that. Okay, Sterling potentially would get into that side. Harry Kane possibly would. But who else would get in to the French side? You know, who else would get, you know, would get into those top sides, even Spain? There aren't too many players that would get into that. So, you know, we are still probably the top eight in the world, you know, and we didn't quite make it on this occasion. And look at the Dutch, the two best centre-backs in the world at the moment.
Yeah, definitely, for sure, on that, form, certainly.
That's the difference. You know, those fine margins make all the difference when you have a... And even De Ligt gave away a penalty.
Well, yeah, it turns out he is human. I think he might have cost Ajax 20 million quid there as well. Danny, I could talk about this all day, but time is catching up with us. Thank you so much for coming on.
Get back to Roland Garros.
Well, honestly, Rafa Nadal's just broken him again. He's playing some unbelievable tennis. Danny, thank you so much as always. And if you ever want to come on as a tennis pundit, we'll definitely have you on. Sounds like you know what you're talking about.
Without a doubt. When was the last time Rafa lost?
You tell me, mate. This is your job interview.
I tell you what, I think it's got to be going back about 9 or 10 years, isn't it?
Oh, I'll take your word for it, Danny. Thank you so much as always. Danny Mills there, former England and Man City defender and tennis expert here on Love Sport Radio.
Love Sport.
Now, I also want to talk about England fans, which we've already done a fair bit this week, but I just got really riled last night. There are a few videos coming in last night and this morning. The fans in the middle of a Portuguese town. I wasn't actually sure if it was Porto or Guimarães in the end, but I understand it was more likely Porto because that's been a little busier. More England fans basically basing themselves in Porto as the bigger place. And I just look. You want to sing these songs, right? 10 German bombers, for example, which goes along the lines of there were 10 German bombers in the air and we shot them down, or something like that. I haven't learned the lyrics for obvious reasons. But in reality, there were a lot more than 10 German bombers. You know, if we're going to be factual about it, there were hundreds. There were thousands of them. Oh, and they weren't just German either. There were British ones too. And they got shot down as well. Just because we won the war, if anyone wins in war, and by the way, no one does, doesn't mean there weren't sacrifices. I'm sure it probably was entirely lost on the hideous choir gathered in a town square in Porto last night that the D-Day commemorations the day before, they didn't feature any celebrations or fireworks. It wasn't like a trophy parade. When those two former soldiers, if you've seen that incredibly moving piece of television where an English and a German soldier met up and, well, effectively had coffee and said, well done, mate, but there weren't bragging rights. It wasn't, oh yeah, we beat you, Jerry. It was none of that, because it's war. No one wins. British bombers, British soldiers, British men, British women, British children, they all got shot down. Just as Japanese bombers and French soldiers, Swedish men, German women, Russian children. But I wouldn't be surprised if next time England go away, someone cooks up a song in the back room of a pub about, you know, the rivers running red with the blood of German civilians. That's the kind of, like, bizarre morons who are standing in the middle of a Portuguese town crowing about winning a war that ended 75 years ago. And I don't excuse them to say that they don't understand, because I don't actually want to believe that anyone in this country is stupid enough to think that the war was a triviality, that it was all over by Christmas and all the soldiers came home to be greeted by adoring crowds and patient wives. They mostly came home shadows of the men that had left, you know, damaged by the horrors of war and not singing songs of victory. Most of them didn't come home at all. Greater love hath no man than this, than a man who lays down his life for his friends. It's a biblical quote, but I always think of it in relation to the First and Second World War, when men went to war because they thought it was the right thing to do and because it was something that all their mates were doing. For their friends, for his Freunden, amigos, Tomodachi. War's not about win or lose, it's only lose. The Second World War shaped the entire political, social and cultural landscape of the 20th century. So how on earth can we really stand here and sing songs about shooting down German bombers? It's likely that these morons don't even realise that when on the 11th of November at 11 a.m. we all stop for a couple of minutes and bow our heads and just keep quiet, we're not just remembering the specific 2 million Brits who were killed in the two Great Wars. We're remembering every dog, cat, horse, man, woman and child killed in a war. Every house flattened by a bomb. Every field where now only poppies grow because the bodies of men feed them. Every undiscovered mass grave. Every concentration camp. Every suicide bomber. Every amputee. Every war. War isn't something we celebrate. In the words of Baldrick, war's a horrid thing. So how dare you? How dare you stand in the middle of a small Portuguese town with your shirt off and celebrate the British Air Force winning the Battle of Britain? The Battle of Britain isn't like the Battle of Stamford Bridge. Not the one in 1066, the one involving a lot of yellow cards. There were no yellow cards in the Battle of Britain, only red ones, and not literal ones, and none followed by the phrase, off you pop. In fact, a lot of people popped off in that particular battle. And I'm not saying that this generation of people are too far removed from the war to understand it. Too far removed from the reality of war. They're the same people who will complain when the Tory government cuts to shreds essential services, but will also sing Sign On when Liverpool come to town, because that has got a lot of unemployment and poverty in that city. It's people who think that when they've had a couple of beers and who knows what else, and they get to a football ground or get in a big group of people, they can just sing. And it doesn't really matter what the words are because it's a nice tune and it's a bit of fun. What have they actually done, I get told on Twitter. What have they done? The words mean absolutely nothing to you. These people are the kind of people who hark after the 1970s because then you could still use the N-word and beat your wife if you wanted to. That's the kind of person you're looking at who thinks that freedom of speech is singing 10 German bombers and songs about the IRA, which to me are just as relevant as each other, or songs about ISIS. You're a football supporter. Who said it was the right arena for you to express your political views? Now, I should stress, and I have to stress, this is not All England fans, and it is a small minority, and that remains true. Far from it being All England fans. But just as a soldier's wartime sacrifice, when he goes to war and is killed for his country, a few giving for the many. Just as that is true, so a few people's idiocy relinquishes the freedom that those few people won. So you don't have to remember a war to realise it was important. And you don't have to be a genius to realise that celebrating someone's death is moronic. But you also have to realise that freedom is a responsibility. And that when you, that small group of people who, by their very definition, by the flags they carry, by the shirts they wear, represent All England fans. And I'm not saying that those England fans necessarily have anything to do with the small minority. But when they wear your shirt and they wear your flag, they become part of you. And it is as much your responsibility to step in and to help with the problem, to campaign for authorities to deal with the problem, as it is anyone else's. Yesterday I said that the FA should start sending a plane full of police out behind every plane full of England fans that goes abroad, because it keeps happening. It also comes from us, as England fans, as people who go abroad. When you hear that one idiot, because it always has to start with one idiot, by the way. These songs, there's not a conductor, someone doesn't stand up and go, one, two, and everyone starts together. It has to start with one. And if you're standing there and one idiot starts singing, there were... Just say, mate, actually, don't do that. Yeah, that's really stupid. Why would you do that? In the words of the FA's video yesterday, don't be that idiot. It's true. But why not be that smart person and point out to that idiot exactly what he is? An idiot.
Love Sport.
This is the James Gray Show on Love Sport Radio. We're here until 3:30 p.m. And we're now going to speak to Rory Dollar, the Press Association cricket reporter who's online. Rory, I understand you've just come out of the pre-match England press conference. What do you think the mood in the camp is like at the moment?
Well, yeah, we've just spoken to both captains. Owen Morgan, very hard to read the mood in the camp from him because he's got a superb poker face. So I certainly wouldn't like to be playing for money with Owen Morgan. So he kept himself pretty chilled. He doesn't like to give too much away, but I think it would be fair to say that England are a little surprised. They thought that they'd done everything right. They beat Pakistan 4-0 in the recent series, and they weren't anticipating that shock result. So it's, you know, things have been the cats amongst the pigeons, put it that way, in the England camp.
You know this setup pretty well. How do you think they will have responded to Monday's fielding performance? Will it have been a case of a big meeting on Tuesday morning and, you know, having some pretty frank conversations, or will they have just taken it in their stride and seen it as a blip?
Well, I can tell you that they had 2 days off.
that's an interesting response.
That was the first thing first. They actually, I mean, they're using home advantage to actually get some time away from the team hotel and to spend time with family. So they actually have, if this was an overseas competition, we would, you know, they'd be in meetings all the time. There'd be training drills every day, but the team have taken a little time off here. So, I mean, I would say with the fielding, it was poor, very poor by this team's standards. But in the first game against South Africa, the team analyst said it was their, you know, they crunch all the numbers, and the analyst said it was their second best fielding performance in 4 years. So I suppose they're taking it as a, maybe one bad day at the office. They certainly wouldn't want to see another, though.
In terms of Bangladesh on Saturday at Cardiff, I was speaking to Nick Howson on the Inside Edge last night, the cricket show here, and he was saying he thinks this is a bit of a nightmare game for England to play at this stage of the tournament off the back of that defeat. Would you go along with that?
Yeah, I do. I do think it's a tricky one, actually. In a way, you know, we've played Bangladesh quite a few times, but they're still not like an Australia who we know inside out. They are a little different, and if anything, they're sort of a similar threat to Pakistan. Really, they've got lots of spin. Certainly, Jason Roy and Johnny Bairstow will be expecting some spin first up, and that's been a tricky thing. They sort of play the game in the same way. They hustle around, they field in close, and they sort of constantly harangue the umpires. So, It could be an awkward one, because it's almost trying to conquer what they've just fallen to in Pakistan. England have only lost, I think, I looked at this yesterday, I think England have played 20 ODIs against Bangladesh. They've only lost four of them, but two of those are at World Cups.
What's the big threat that Bangladesh carry? If England fans, or, you know, fair-weather England fans, as there are many in the World Cup, what's the big threat to worry about from Bangladesh?
Well, Shakib Al Hassan is the sort of standard answer, really, when it comes to Bangladesh. And he has been for a long time. Like, we think about Ben Stokes as being a real premier all-rounder, does everything, bats, balls, catches. But for almost the entirety of their time playing international cricket together, Shakib's been rated higher than him as an all-rounder. He does great things with the ball. If he doesn't come off with the ball, he invariably gets runs. He's a sort of he's a low-key superstar, really, Shakib. And he's been, for nearly all of his career, he's been in the top two or three all-rounders in world cricket. So, you know, he's going to probably bowl the first over of the day. He'll have a go at the openers. And he's a tremendous competitor. And he's experienced beating England before, and he'll be the one they're watching out for.
Well, from low-key superstar Shakib Al Hassan to high-key superstar Rory Dollar, thank you so much for joining us. Always a pleasure to have you on. Rory Dollar, cricket reporter for the Press Association there. And now we've got another low-key superstar in George Belshaw, live from Roland Garros. George, we've just seen Rafa Nadal sweep Roger aside. How impressive was that performance from Rafa?
Oh, there's nothing low-key about me.
he said in a very low-key way.
yeah, I mean, it was inevitably terrific from Rafa, as always. You know, there's no...
You sound like you've run out of superlatives.
Like, yeah, I mean, there's no sort of word to kind of say just what a force he is. I mean, there's barely anyone in history who can hold a candle to the sort of thing he's done here in the past.
Do you think Roger mixed up his game enough to try and undo Rafa?
I think it was difficult for him. I mean, I don't know how much you've seen in terms of the kind of conditions here, but it's impossibly windy. You could see the kind of clay kind of flying off the floor because of just how awful the wind is. It's very, very blustery. So I think that upsetted Roger's game a bit. And Rafa is known to be one of the best guys to ever kind of play in the wind. He's from Mallorca, where they have a lot of wind there, so it's something he does practice in quite a lot comparatively to probably Roger. Just dealt with it better, really. I mean, Roger needed every single thing to go right for him that possibly could to win this match, and it didn't simply. And he almost took a spectator's hat off by thumping the ball into the crowd. I don't know if you've seen that. I mean, that is a,
well, yeah, and I wondered.
Terrific video.
I thought that bloke looked like the maitre d' from First Dates, which I don't know. I might be wrong, but maybe just all French people with beards look like him. Maybe that's the case. I don't know. Certainly, from what I saw, George, despite all the wind, which I can now see behind John Inverdale's head on the ITV coverage, it does look very serious. Do you think we'll see Roger at Roland Garros again? I've just seen him clapping his way off court and waving to the crowd. It doesn't feel like goodbye, more au revoir.
I mean, it's really tough to say. I mean, there's a lot. He got kind of chanted off the court with big cries of Roger, Roger, Roger from the French Open crowd. It did sort of feel like a farewell in many ways. And the big question for him next year is he'll be focusing on the Olympics mainly. So will he want to be playing French Open before going into that? You know, that's kind of extra matches. I don't know. I mean, there's a, kind of a suggestion that this is a farewell to the French Open. But, I mean, that's not based on anything factually
that's you
accurate.
Just making it up on the spot, isn't it, George?
Which,
well, that's pretty much all you do. Yeah, exactly.
It is, yeah.
Let me just... I know today's a really busy day and I appreciate your time, mate, but let me just pull you back to early this morning. Jo Konta, she had that second set in the palm of her hand. She had the first set chances too. Opportunity missed, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no way to dress it up. She missed a drive volley in the first set, had on one of the set points at 5-3 up. Sent it a couple of feet beyond the baseline and never really recovered from that moment. I mean, you're right, she had chances in the second set as well, but it just felt like the moment got too big for her. And the sad thing to say about this is she's never going to get a better chance than that, I don't think. You know, it's been a very, very kind of kind draw. Obviously, she beat Sloane Stephens, which is the biggest obstacle she's run into, but you know, this was the moment where real champions kind of will win that match. You know, she had it on a racket and didn't quite happen. So I hope it's not the last time we see her at this stage of a Grand Slam, but I struggle to see her getting a better opportunity to do that again, really.
Just before I let you go, George, do you think Dominic Thiem can do the impossible this afternoon and lose to Djokovic in four?
I think it'll be 3 or 4 to Novak. I mean, Thiem's playing some great stuff and I don't want to write him off, but Novak is operating at a completely different level to anyone who's not named Rafael Nadal here. And I think, in honesty, that's the final we need here. You know, Novak's the only man I can see beating Rafa here. And whether I can actually see him doing it is another question at all, given how Rafa's just completely dismantled Roger. But, you know, that's the match we all want, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. George, thank you so much. Always a pleasure. George Belshaw there, Metro.co.uk, tennis reporter, also co-host of the Love Tennis podcast with my good self.
Love Sport.
A lot of people have lumped in on England fans in the last 24 hours and calling our English fans a disgrace. The England fans in this stadium tonight were absolutely incredible.
And we should say as well, they were in mixed sections.
Mixed
in
sections,
the
there wasn't any trouble. There was 20,000, 25,000 England fans in here tonight who've probably paid upwards of £1,000 to come here and be here and have behaved impeccably. And I hope that that is reported as much as the few idiots.
They haven't all behaved well, Gary.
I hope that's reported as much. I hope that's as much as a few people throwing bottles who are idiots, because they were outstanding in this stadium tonight.
You understand why the others are making headlines, don't you?
Dave, I do understand why the others are making headlines, and it is a problem that England fans have had. My point is, 20,000 England fans in this stadium tonight have been absolutely impeccable.
Gary Neville talking to Sky Sports there and talking absolute nonsense. Now, I don't disagree with him that it's important that whenever we talk about this, we point out that the majority of England fans on these trips behave perfectly well. But if he wants me to spend my radio show basically talking about all the people who were well behaved yesterday, that's all he's going to hear. I'm going to sit here and go, up at the Northampton Town versus Coventry game, there was no trouble. At Burton Albion versus West Bromwich, there was no trouble. And you know what? I'm going to make Gary Neville do that as well. I'm going to say, Gary, can you stop talking about all the mistakes that defender made? And can you go through every pass and tackle that he successfully made? That's not how news works, mate. people aren't interested in 19,000 England fans behaving well in Portugal. It may be true, but there's a reason that when Dom Betts gets back from Portugal, I'm not going to look at his holiday photos, because he just did boring things and went on wine tours. I'm not interested in it, and no one is. So why on earth would we write stories and do news reports about fans behaving well, when realistically there are probably a couple of hundred of Englishmen out in Portugal acting like morons, singing songs about the IRA and German bombers and ISIS? I'm not going to report. Of course, I'll mention, and I have every single time we've talked about this, that the majority of England fans are being nice and lovely and just having cups of tea and maybe just offering biscuits to the locals. But there's also a few England fans who we have to talk about, because if you don't talk about these idiots, they go on being idiots. If you let them sit in the shadows and just skulk and cause problems without it being highlighted in the media, no one ever does anything about it. You've met the FA, Gary. You know what the FA are like. If they don't have to deal with it, they won't. If they know that an issue has happened but they don't have to deal with it, they won't. We are the people who make these things go away, and you are part of that media, Gary. You're part of that group of people who can stand up and say, actually, this is not okay, and if the FA aren't going to do something about it, let's do something about it as a society, as a group of football supporters. Because that's what the media are, right? They're an extension and a voice of football supporters. And sometimes, those 19,000 fans can't sing louder than the 1,000 fans or 500 fans or 200 fans singing 10 German bombers, because they're not as cohesive. They are the loud minority. They are the 19,000, the silent majority. So I'm afraid that sometimes we have to highlight the morons going on tour with England, if only to get rid of them. I'm not doing it because I want to sit here and talk about how idiotic England fans have been. I would much rather be sitting here talking to Alan O'Brien about how the Dutch centre-back splitting and Frankie de Jong dropping in made for a fascinating tactical battle against an England front three deprived of first their best and then their second best player. But we can't, because it's more important on the whole to talk about the fact that England fans are still going abroad, and some of them, a minority, but still some of them are being idiots. When was the last time you watched the news, Gary, and the first segment was 99.5% of trains today were on time? No, they report the 0.5% that weren't on time, because that's how news works. So if you want to talk about England fans behaving well, being underreported, I look forward to Monday Night Football next time you're on it, because it's all going to be about how very well behaved and quiet all the players were.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. Remember to leave us a rating and a review, but only nice ones. I don't take criticism well.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. So just like you, he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.